From high school water polo to Top Gun fighter pilot, Mike Peterson had quite the journey as a young man. Landing and taking off from aircraft carriers, flying F-14 jets in multiple deployments in the Middle East, being part of fighter groups that were nicknamed the Ghost Riders and the Jolly Rogers and the Black Lions and even the Bounty Hunters, Mike had a lot of bravado when he was younger. In fact, maybe a sense of invincibility. He was bulletproof, and he was proud. And then Mike had several tense moments. Pilots call them pucker moments. You can Google that if you want to. Lives were often on the line, and one time in particular he feared he may have fired on the wrong guys. Our guys. Fellow Americans. To his great relief, he soon learned that he had not. In fact, his mission had been successful. He had saved the Americans from the enemy. And in a matter of seconds, his day went from what he was fearing was going to be the worst in his life to actually one of the best in his life. He explains that three wars and many scary moments began to drag on him. What about all those guys that he had killed, even if they were the enemy? Was he doing the right thing? He began wondering if God would forgive him. And so he started digging into Scripture, leaning on his Creator and Savior. He started to become less invincible. He became more vulnerable. And he became less prideful. He was also humbled when he and his wife became parents of a child with special needs. His transition from the high-flying life of a Navy fighter pilot to civilian life required many adjustments. Little did he know that one of the biggest challenges ever was when he became the school board president of a liberal school district in Colorado. Now that was eye-opening. Today, Mike helps run a successful consulting firm from his home near Troy, Montana, which is just across the border from Idaho. He travels across the country conducting workshops and teaching businesses how to apply lessons that he learned from his naval aviation Top Gun experience. And he also throws in lessons he continues to learn from Scripture. And don't hit that stop button too quickly at the end of our conversation. We have a special salute to all of our brave pilots, and it is especially fitting for our guest, Mike. Please join me as I visit with Mike Peterson right after this short message from our sponsor. I am very excited to introduce my first sponsor of this podcast. We here at Almost Paradise in North Idaho were having major issues of internet speed that have been impacting our podcast in a very negative way. It would often take hours to upload and download my podcast, and I don't want to get technical on it because I'm not a very technical person myself, but just say it impacted my ability to edit and then publish my podcast a lot. Sometimes the speed was so slow that it would time out. I think most of you probably know what time out means, forcing me to start the editing and uploading process all over from scratch. Joy would be downstairs and would always know when I was having issues, as I would occasionally scream at my computer in frustration. And that wasn't fair. It wasn't fair to Joy, and it wasn't even fair to my computer. It wasn't my computer's fault. And it wasn't fair to my blood pressure either. One day, I ran into Eric, the owner of EL Internet. And a light bulb went off in my head. And I started sharing with him the issue I was having. I had previously learned from a different independent source that my upload speed at my house was less than 1 megabyte. Now, I don't know what that means. All I know is it was really slow. Eric informed me that with his service, my speed would be about 10 and sometimes as high as 20 to upload. He assured me I would have no issues downloading or uploading anymore. I decided to make the jump. And what a jump it was. With cautious optimism, I transferred my first podcast using EL Internet into my editing program, and I waited. In the past, this usually took anywhere from 30 to 60 minutes, and sometimes longer. I literally choked on my coffee as the transfer took 2 minutes. 2 minutes. I think that's 120 seconds. Wow. I will let you know next week how long it takes me to actually upload this podcast to my distributing platform, which is up in the cloud. That has always taken 2 to 3 hours or longer. I am excited to find out. So if you are having speed issues or connectivity issues with your internet service, I strongly urge you to consider giving Eric and his staff a call and learn more about his service here in North Idaho. His number is 208-946-4147, or you can check out his business on the internet at elinternetnw.com. That's elinternetnw.com. And tell Eric that I sent you. That would be helpful. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another exciting podcast of Almost Paradise here in North Idaho. And I have a special guest here today, and his name is Mike Peterson. Mike, how you doing?
Just great, Ted.
All right. Mike is actually very symbolic of a number of things because he is my 71st guest. And 71 is an important number for me because I am 71 years old and I graduated in the class of 71 from high school. And now you're my 71st guest. So
happy to be here on the Trifecta Podcast.
The Trifecta Podcast. That'll be the headline. Okay, let's get this going. And I know you because you have a daughter that goes to our church.
Yeah, that's my middle daughter, Roxy, Roxanne. And she's a resident here in Almost Paradise, which is Bonner's Ferry.
But now, technically, you're not in Almost Paradise of North Idaho.
My wife and I live across state lines in a completely different state in a completely different time zone, only about 40 minutes away over in Troy, Montana.
Yes, that's right. So you can't really claim Idaho at all as your piece of paradise. You got your own piece of paradise.
Yeah, and I would say the Almost Paradise concept definitely is not bounded by state boundaries. So I will also claim that it is Almost Paradise up in my neck of the woods.
And because you were from a different time zone, you're reliving an extra hour here now?
I actually traveled back in time just to be on this podcast.
Wow. And then you're going to jump back when you leave into the present.
Yeah, into the future. I don't have a DeLorean out there. I've got a Toyota Tacoma, but it'll do the job.
Back to the Future. There you go. One of my favorite movies. That's right. So we are about 30 miles from the Canadian border for those new listeners from Australia or South America or Naples, Idaho, whatever. And now you're in Troy, Montana, roughly. Is that correct?
Yeah, just south of the little town of Troy. It's probably, right now it's grown. It's probably about 900 people.
Yeah, and we play you in football a lot and stuff like that. So that's kind of cool. So what would you say makes this area Almost Paradise?
I would say more than anything, it's the people. The first thing that you notice when you come up in this area is just the incredible natural beauty. You see God's hand at work in everything, the mountains, the streams, the beautiful Kootenai River Valley, which we share over.
We do share. Yes.
And it's the first thing that people notice is just the beautiful nature. But I think the real secret to being Almost Paradise is the people you surround yourself with up here in the Panhandle and in the northwest section of Montana.
Okay. And then what is it that makes this not quite paradise?
Not quite paradise is it's the same thing. We have a lot of people.
Too many
Now
people.
a lot of people is relative, especially, Montana just, I guess last census just went over 1 million for the entire state. So it's not a high density location, but where there's people, there's goodness, but where there's people, there's always going to be some degree of friction and conflict.
So, why are you here, Mike?
Well, I thought I'd come in and talk to you. I'm a loyal listener of the Almost Paradise
Yes,
podcast.
Mike is the one who listens to my
And I
podcast.
derive a lot out of it. Just keeping up on not just what's local up here. Obviously, there's a focus on the north part of Idaho, but also keeping up with enduring things, truths. I really enjoy the focus as we've moved a little bit more into the faith component, which is definitely a contributor to it being almost paradise up here.
Yes, I had a deep voice one day, accompanied with a clap of thunder that said, "Ted, I want you to do this." So, and so when you get a voice like that, you gotta do what they say. So, what'd you do before you moved here?
Yeah, I had an interesting background, tracing all the way back to my childhood. I came from as far away from almost paradise as you can probably get in the US. I grew up in a row home in Philadelphia. My dad was a cop and my mom was a teacher. And so started out there, grew up through the Philadelphia public school system. And then not only could I swim pretty fast, I could do it while throwing a ball. So I came into a little sport called water polo, which usually you only find in California, but you find it on the East Coast as well in some pockets. And I was able to get recruited to go to college to play water polo at a place that otherwise I would have never found myself. So next thing you know, I was at the United States Naval Academy playing on the water polo team. And
Well, that makes sense. There's a connection there.
that actually
There's
makes
a,
sense.
yeah,
Yeah.
okay.
And we hire all our graduates. So right out of the Naval Academy, went into the service, did 21 years of commissioned service after my 4 years in the academy. Then spent the last 15 years kind of roaming around the world doing some consulting stuff. And then a little over a year and a half ago, my wife and I left Colorado and moved up here.
Now we got something else in common there because Joy and I moved here from Colorado. We lived in Loveland, south of Denver, and you're up north of Denver.
I was south of Denver. I was
I mean, no, we were north of Denver. I
you
got
were
my
just north
directions
and I
messed up.
was down between Colorado Springs and Denver. Closest town of any size would be Castle Rock in that
Yes,
area.
yeah, and we were north of Denver, right at the entrance of Rocky Mountain National Park.
Yeah, beautiful.
Now I'm going to compare. We decided to move here because it was just getting so heavily populated on the Front Range, what we call the Front Range or the mountains there. I mean, you look to the west and there's beautiful mountains. You look to the east and you can see all the way to the grain elevators of Kansas, just about. It's as flat as a pancake. And so we were right there on the Front Range, and man, the people, it's just amazing. How long did you live there?
Let's see. I came to Colorado in 2004 down to Peterson Air Force Base. Did 3 years there, spent a year remote unaccompanied tour, they call it. So a year gone without my family. I was a overseas naval base executive officer. Then I came back to Colorado for my last 3 years where I was an exchange instructor. I was actually an assistant professor at the Air Force Academy, but I was still in the Navy, just doing
And
a cross-service transfer.
they're in Colorado Springs,
Yeah,
in
right
that
there in the
area.
Springs.
Yeah. Now, I and we also we another reason we moved here was it was just the politics were shifting in Colorado, and Joy had a little 5-acre ranchette, not really a ranchette, it's just 5 acres with a couple of horses, but she didn't have any water rights. And water rights is a big deal there.
Big deal in Colorado.
Very
Have
expensive to get one.
intercourse up
Yes,
here.
oh my gosh. And you got neighbors that are watching you to make sure you're not drilling a well illegally or diverting water from a water ditch or whatever. And we just, I mean, a water right was like, what, $20,000 or it's a lot. It's a
Yeah,
lot.
there was, I forget what the break point was, but it was a little over 30 acres, I think, where there were different rules and things. So the big thing was to get property over 30 or whatever it was acres. Yeah.
Which we that wasn't going to happen. So anyway, we just decided it was time for a change. So and here we are, and we're very, very happy to be here. I assume you're happy to be here too.
Yeah, and for the same reasons, really, it comes down to people and politics is the reason that we moved as well.
Now, How, and this is an interesting story that we asked before we turned on the microphone. How did you meet your wife? Because now your wife is, oh, what's her name?
Charlotte.
Charlotte, that's right. I knew that. Charlotte's Web. Yes.
Yeah,
Charlotte.
we met in the Navy. So my time in the Navy was spent flying on and off aircraft carriers. So flew the F-14 Tomcat, and then towards the end of my flying portion of my career, flew the F-18F Super Hornet, the two-seat model that replaced the Tomcat. And when I was a young student going through the F-14 training squadron, I met my wife there. She was a dedicated legal officer to take care of all of us young officer students and all the young enlisted maintainers that were working on the jets because we tended to get in trouble. And her job was to lay down the law according to the Uniform Code of Military Justice and keep us in line.
So specifically, did she meet you bailing you out of jail?
No, not at all.
Did you just ask her out one night or
We
any?
were invited to a mutual friend's house for dinner, and there were other folks invited, and the rest of them bailed, and it wound up being the three of us. At which point in the evening, he just kind of sat in the corner by himself because the two of us hit it off so well that
Oh,
he,
wow.
and,
Too bad, so sad.
the rest is history, as they
That's the way
say.
it goes. The rest is history. So now I got to ask you this. So you flew these fancy jets and went through Top Gun school. Did you teach at Top Gun school?
No, so first, to be really clear, I was a naval flight officer. For those that have seen the original Top Gun, I
I
was
was going to
Goose.
ask about
Yeah,
that.
I was Goose, not Maverick. So I ran the weapon systems. And if you ask any Navy pilot, it's kind of like a corporate limousine model, the important or limo model. The important guy sits in the back, makes all the decisions, has all the cool toys. And I was so important to the Navy that they issued me a chauffeur, also known as the pilot, to take me where I needed to go and get the
Okay,
missions that I
so
needed.
it's like a limousine, and the real
Pretty
important
much.
guy's in the back seat.
Exactly.
Yeah,
And
then you
every
got the
pilot will tell you
driver.
the same thing.
Okay. So, God, I wish I had Tom Cruise here to counter that, perhaps, or whatever. But so, did you, when you were like 5, 10 years old, did you go, I want to be a pilot?
I saw Top Gun, the first one that came out in 1986, and that was my final year in high school before I went to the Naval Academy. Playing water polo, I honestly wanted to be a Navy SEAL, but I didn't know at the
Oh.
time that your eyesight had to be fairly good. Mine was bad and getting worse. So I actually couldn't even be a pilot by the time I graduated. But because I was correctable to 20/20, I could sit in the back and be a naval flight officer. And then shortly after that, I got laser eye surgery. And then I was seeing 20/15 for decades. It was really good.
You could have been a Navy SEAL.
No, not at the time
No.
because I didn't meet the raw basic eye requirements to go in.
Yeah. Yeah. So you could, but you could be a Navy SEAL today.
Eyesight, yes.
About
Physical, the
it.
rest of it, no.
No. So when's the last time you flew?
Last time I flew in a jet for the Navy was, let me figure that out, would have been 2004. So it's been a bit of time.
Little bit of time, 22 years, is that right? Yeah. So now, did you fly in the Middle East, Iraq?
Yeah, I did multiple deployments. I was with the Ghost Riders, the Jolly Rogers. I went to Top Gun, graduated there, and I didn't teach at Top Gun, but I was stationed at the East Coast. They called it SWATSLANT, Strike Weapons and Tactics School Atlantic. So I was a weapons and tactics instructor for all the F-14 squadrons based on the East Coast. Did that for a while, went during a shore tour, they call it, and deployed to the war over in Kosovo at the time. Came back, went to another squadron, the Black Lions, and was actually on deployment during 9/11. We were right east of the Straits of Hormuz, off the coast of Iran, Pakistan, that area when 9/11 happened. So wound up staying there and was part of the whole opening strikes in Afghanistan. Then switched air wings, went to what would be my final squadron, the Bounty Hunters, and kicked off the whole Iraqi freedom invasion of Iraq. Did that for about 6 months. Came back, switched to the Super Hornet, and that was the end of my flying career, although I had many years left in the Navy.
So, did you have any? How do I delicately say this? Sometimes some people refer to it as a pucker moment. Just a, oh, this is bad.
Yeah, there are quite a few of those. So I haven't been in three shooting wars. And if
Things
you saw
happen.
the movie Top Gun, you think it's all about dogfighting, aerial combat. And that's where it originated back in the days of Vietnam. We weren't performing as we expected to, so the Top Gun school was put together to teach the art of dogfighting or aerial combat. But it evolved over the years, and the Navy, almost all its aircraft are now what we call strike fighters. They just don't do the air-to-air mission or the counter-air mission. They also do bombing, they do electronic attack, they do suppression of enemy air defenses, they do a whole bunch of stuff. So I spent almost all of my time as a trained forward air controller, which not everybody in the squadron was qualified or trained to do that. So my job was to go generally loiter in the battle space, wait for the guys on the ground to get in close contact with the enemy, get really sideways. And I was trained to orchestrate air fire, air support to bomb the bad guys off the good guys in very close proximity. So that's what I did most of the time. And that usually involves these relatively good pucker factor.
Yeah, you got to do it right.
And it's not so much for yourself, because in the theaters of war where I was, there wasn't a lot of danger to us, not air to air. No, we were nobody was going to come shoot us down in another aircraft. Our threats mainly came from the ground, people shooting at us from the ground. But with the mission that I did, if you were too hasty and you did not take the time to figure out your situational awareness and where the good guys were and the bad guys were, worst case, you could kill the friendlies. But if you took too long to figure it out, the friendlies could be dying in the meantime. So there was a bit, as you say, a pucker
You
factor
just had a
associated.
tremendous amount of responsibility.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, was there much with drones then?
Not so much. The drones were mainly used for reconnaissance, surveillance. They had armed drones. I worked with a couple of them on submissions. They started putting little missiles on them, generally anti-tank missiles called Hellfire missiles, that were generally anti-armor missiles, but they were lightweight, shaped charge, and they would use those to take out vehicles, things like that. They're becoming obviously more and more advanced in the modern age.
Yeah, and
Yeah.
I know I'm like a little boy in a candy factory here right now. It's okay. I mean, I used to study World War II, and I'd play around with, I was never in the military, but this is just all fascinating to me. And we did talk briefly, and I don't want to make this the main issue, but you're kind of familiar with what happened with the Iranian strike that we did with the B-2 bombers. And if you a couple minutes on that, what do you know about that and how that works?
Yeah, for folks that aren't familiar, the second Top Gun movie wasn't too bad. Completely fictional, but they were dropping bunker buster bombs.
Yes, bunker buster
If you want to
bombs.
look it up on the internet, GBU-24s or what they were dropping. I've dropped them in combat. It's all in the packaging. They're heavyweight bombs with a low amount of explosive, but the whole point of that bomb is to get the explosive down in where it needs to go. Now, the ones that were used over in Iran were a whole nother level. I mean, we were carrying on the Tomcat weapons that weighed about 2,300 pounds a piece. These things were like 30,000 pounds. That's like half the weight of our entire aircraft with fuel and ordnance, roughly out there. So we're talking really, really big bombs, but it's all about getting the package down into where it needs to go to do the damage that you expect.
That was similar. Yes, that was very similar to the second Top Gun
Yeah.
or movie. And it was also similar to the original Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
You
Except you
know?
don't get off our targeting devices and use the force, but
No,
yeah.
no. And you
Yeah.
weren't in space and
Yeah.
all that kind of stuff. And there wasn't a Death Star. But I mean, it's amazing the science fiction becomes science fact in many ways.
Yeah.
And so when people make fun of science fiction movies, just fast forward to maybe 10 or 15, 20 years, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, okay. So yeah, I find that fascinating. So what do you do today? What are you doing today? I mean, your life was pretty, to me, your life was pretty exciting back then. So
Yeah, it was exciting.
how did you transition from military life to civilian life? What happened
Yeah,
there?
that's a tough one. When I finished up my time and I was getting ready to retire, I looked at the skills I had, and I knew a lot about laser targeting and night vision and infrared and all those things. So I almost took a contractor job over in Afghanistan flying, a blimp on a string. It was basically the same sensor packages that I operated from the cockpit, but they were just sticking up on a static blimp to surveil things and help guide ground forces in and around Kabul and places. But I decided not to do that. I spent enough time being away from the family and doing that type of stuff. So I joined a consultancy and worked with one company. And now, for the last few years, I've been working with my new company, but in the same field. We work with a lot of what are called high reliability or high consequence organizations. Those organizations that cannot eliminate risk, just their mission is inherently risky. And when things go bad, it goes from whoops to oh bleep really quickly. And things tend
Oh,
toward,
bleep. I like
yeah,
that.
things
Oh,
tend
bleep.
towards the catastrophic. So we work with them on leadership development, team optimization, and organizational learning using a lot of the best practices that we used in military aviation.
Okay. So now, today, 2025, what are you doing for fun and profit?
What are we doing for fun? Oh, I'll tell you what, being up here in paradise, I do a lot of stuff for fun. It involves being on rivers and kayaking and out and hiking and picking huckleberries. And they're on the bush in the morning and they're in the cobbler in the evening. So that's what I love doing up
Okay.
there.
But what are you doing do you have your own consulting company?
Yeah, I'm a co-owner with a couple other folks. We're relatively small. Almost all of us are military veterans. And so we'll go out with organizations that are searching for some type of ways to overcome operational upsets. So if they're not meeting their expectations, we'll help them with organizational learning. A lot of times they're seeking optimization, so they're seeking to outcompete competitors, or they're just looking for some type of organizational culture change. They just want it to be a better, happier, more fulfilling place to work.
Okay, so somewhere along here in your last 20, 30 years or something, I get the sense that your life shifted spiritually.
Yeah.
What happened there? Where were you and where are you and how did that shift happen?
Yeah, I grew up going to Sunday school like a lot of folks out there. I didn't like it because we had to dress up and the shoes were not fun to put on and things. So we went to Sunday school when I was little, but I wouldn't say that I had a faith-based relationship with the Lord. In the military, I'll honestly say to go through Top Gun and be a quote a fighter guy, there's a lot of hubris there. There's a lot of people that have a lot of pride. And I was one of those people. I thought I was bulletproof and invincible, and there was no problem that I couldn't solve. And you quickly find out after certainly going to three wars, it drags on you, right? Fog and friction of war. There was a day I honestly thought for about 15 minutes I had killed some friendlies. It turned out I didn't. They asked us pretty much to drop on their position, and I heard no answer, radio contact after that happened for about 15 minutes. They did come up 15 minutes later, and it went from the worst day of my life to one of the better days. But that drags on you, and it makes you ask a lot of really important questions. Am I doing the right thing? Will I ever be forgiven? And it started making me really dig into scripture. And then the biggest change in my life came when my daughter was born, my middle daughter. I'd had one daughter back in 2000. I came back from the war in Afghanistan and had my second daughter before going back to Iraq. And she had some special needs. And boy, will that humble you as a parent. You don't know how to fight that battle, right? That's something you're not equipped for. And it was really brought me a great degree of humility. It was something I knew I couldn't work through and do on my own, and I was going to need help with. So I would say that that was probably the biggest step change for me to get closer to the word and to scripture and to start have a personal relationship and start listening to God's plan instead of just talking all the time, soften my heart. And then I would say the last big bit that really convicted me is, warfare's it's pretty honest. It's a boxing match, right? They're trying to kill you, you're trying to kill them, good and evil, at least in your mind at the time. And then I ran for school board. And if you want to talk about a spiritual battle of principalities and just there is a lot of shadowy bad stuff out there. go surf on the school board and deal with society. So I found myself fighting a more nuanced battles, more jujitsu than boxing, which was the military battle and had to be a little bit more
Now,
nuanced.
the school board, this was in Colorado.
Yeah, this was in Colorado.
This was not here, our Bonner's Ferry
No,
School District.
I
No,
ran.
no.
It was the middle of COVID. I was complaining about the things that were being done to us, churches shut down, schools being shut down, businesses being shut down. And frankly, my wife got tired of me complaining and yelling at the TV. And we were actually sitting in a church down there in off of Castle Rock, the Rock Church. And they had a speaker come that was recruiting people for school board. And my wife and I talked about it briefly why the speaker was up there. And by the time I said, "Hey, honey, I need to use the restroom. Let's talk about this on the way home," I walked out of the restroom and she said, "There he is. He'll do it." And I said, "What am I doing?" She says, "You're running for school board, jerky," although she used a different word. And next thing you know, I was running for school board and was elected and was the president of the board for 2 years down there.
So what did you experience and what'd you learn?
Oh, wow, I learned a lot. I just wanted to get the kids back in school. I wanted to reverse the course of some of the things I saw going on in the classroom that weren't academic. Very, very political, a lot of agendas down there. And I wanted to restore the voice of the parent. I would sum up my lessons here. I tried to do that. If I could do it all over again, I would just be more overt in basing my decisions as a board member on what I think was truly biblical and just lean into it a little bit more than I did.
Okay, but you were kind of, I don't know, just what do you mean exactly by being more overt? What's an example of
Yeah,
that?
try to balance the realities. I guess it's kind of like landing a fish. You want to move the needle, but if you pull too hard and too fast, you cause a backlash. And it's hard to, in a practical way, get things done. So you have to move it incrementally and slowly over time towards where you want it to go. And what I didn't realize before I got on the school board, but I realize now it's like governing by executive order. You can go in and you can turn over the tables and you can put in policies, but there's nothing to keep the next school board, should things flip, from coming in and doing the same thing and erasing everything you're done. So maybe trying to embed things a little bit more and make them a little more permanent so they couldn't just be undone with the political ebbs and flows.
Do you have any kids in the school now?
Not now. My
No.
youngest graduated high school. She is also up here at Bonner's Ferry because it's so awesome. And she did some vocational training, but all of our kids are out of the school system.
I would think our school system, though, is not the same as what you were experiencing in Colorado.
Oh no, we had a lot of identity politics being put in, a lot of, frankly, what I think was anti-Americanism, putting in a lack of understanding of the truly exceptional country that we have, that America is uniquely founded upon natural rights, and that is not the norm, and we should be proud of that.
I encourage people to attend the school board meetings, get to know your teachers, your children's teachers, personal basis, see what's going on in the classroom. You don't have to be antagonistic, just be observant and helpful, and that can have a lot of influence in the classroom. Get to know your superintendent, get to know your principal, get to know what's going on. That's enough. And I don't want to say this in a bad way, but it's just enough to keep everybody accountable and responsible. And you've got children in the game, so you're in the game. And so that's what needs to be done. We really struggled getting a levy passed here. Finally, it did pass, but there was a number of people, there's a little bit of a trust issue. And the best way to fix that trust is get more aware of what's going on and you have an impact. That was my recommendation when that was all going down a few months ago. So yeah, would you agree with that as a form
Yeah,
of
I would agree. You really need to have trust. Trust with the community, trust with the district. At the end of the day, the mindset I took is that the school board and the entire school system, superintendent on down, really were in the service industry. And the clients, the customers were the students and the parents. And we really needed to be aware and reactive to what the students and the parents foremost desired in education. That being said, they need a certain amount of resourcing to be able to succeed in that vision.
now, so that was kind of a battle for you in your life at that time, and you mentioned something about everyday battles versus actual combat. What do you mean by that?
I mean, combat's very black and white. Good guys, bad guys, maps, lines, things like that. Where everyday battles are just how do you get up every day? How do you interface with everybody, quote unquote, friend and foe alike? I'd be very resistant to put anybody permanently in the friend bucket or permanently in the foe bucket. I mean, maybe that's one of the good lessons that came out of Afghanistan. Meet people where they are on any given day and then try to move them in a positive direction.
And be open to listening more and talking less.
Oh, absolutely. You really can't move somebody if you can't empathize with them. And I don't mean sympathy and I don't mean compassion. If you can't kind of see the word through their eyes, kind of read back to them and say, let me see if I have this right. Even if you disagree with them, but if they say, yeah, that's right, that's what I mean, now you can start a dialogue and have a
You
conversation.
don't have to surrender
No.
your position or your values, just talk. And find out what's going on. And maybe there's a middle ground in there somewhere that you can work out.
Right.
You mentioned mission success related to our everyday life, kind of mission success. How would you define that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things. First of all, figure out what your mission is. Right? What is it that you are here to do? What is it that you're trying to do? And there are some things, whether it's in our consulting business or whether it's in just how you live your life, there are probably four things that I've borrowed from the whole Naval Aviation Top Gun experience that really kind of guide things. And I would say the first one that absolutely you learn in Top Gun, you learn in the Navy, is it's a team sport. If you think to Top Gun 1 and Top Gun 2, yeah, the movies were a little bit cheesy. Yeah, there was a lot that's not very real in there. But if you peel back the onion, they're the exact same movie. At the core of those movies are when I'm facing life's most difficult challenges, when I'm up against it, who do I want as my wingman, right? Because the first one is, do I trust Iceman? Is he going to be there? Is he not going to be there, right? Who do I want as a wingman? And the second one is, I got to assemble a team for this really important strike. And who's the guy they kick out? Hangman, because he's going to hang you out to dry and he's not going to be there. Now he redeems himself at the end of the movie, spoiler, but he doesn't get to be part of the team because the team is about who do I trust. So to translate that into kind of everyday life, pick a good team, right? So if you translate that into a Christian lifestyle, find a good church. Find one that aligns with your values. Find a congregation that you can be open with, right?
It's about who your friends are,
Yeah, it's about who your friends
your
are.
peers.
Yeah. And that would maybe to the second thing. So the first one is kind of life is a team sport. Pick a good wingman, surround yourself with people you trust, which may not be the most experienced. They may not be the most intelligent, in terms of book training, knowledgeable, but to the people that you can really trust. That's more important than skill. And then the second one that I would bring in there is that the highest performing teams, whether you're talking Top Gun, whether you're talking Navy SEALs, they're really built on a foundation of trust. The first thing you have to do in your team is build relations and build trust. And the reason that leads to performance is once you establish that trust with each other, now you can offer each other critiques. I can say, hey, Ted, yeah, I got a little something for you. And it may be critical, but it's out of a truly deeper compassion. I'm trying to make you better, and I expect you to say, hey, Mike, I got a little something for you, right? And I have to have the humility to take that in. Why? Iron sharpens iron, right? We are constantly seeking to improve each other and improve our organizations, whether that's a church, whether that's a corporation, but it always has to start with trust. Trust leading to critiques to better each other, and then you get that improvement. So I would say that's a critical one.
And
And
that,
then,
yeah, go ahead.
yeah, and then just maybe moving down those, we were masters of learning in naval aviation. We were, the Marine Corps uses this term expeditionary. That's a fancy word for we're masters of everything and we make it up as we go, right? So in naval aviation, we tried to quickly learn what the enemy was doing, what the tactics were, what the situation was on the battlefield. And then we would take action on that learning. In a corporate environment, we tell a lot of our clients, we think lessons learned stink because you label them as a lesson learned and all they're really done is noted, written down, or entered into some fancy spreadsheet. But are you actually doing something different based on that knowledge? So how do we go from learning or a lesson learned to lessons implemented? Right? How do we use knowledge to change the way we act in the future? And I think that's a really key one because we don't really learn until we apply our knowledge. And where do we see that in a spiritual life? We see these closeted Christians, right? I hold my faith as the greatest secret known to man and only me. Or we are passive people of principles. We hold these deep principles that we would never violate, but do we act on them or do we share them? So being able to just step out, and again, it's not about works, it's about faith, but to step out and be to both love and fear God and to be a good neighbor, those are active endeavors. That's not a state of mind. That's in how you do and how you act. So take that learning, take that knowledge, and then live it. Go do the do. And then I would say the very last one, if I'm going down my list of things that I learned from Top Gun that you can apply to a good Christian life, I would say the last one, and it's a little bit more abstract, is this idea, because you asked the question, what is the key to mission success? In aviation, we'll tell you it's adaptive capacity. That's a fancy term. It means the means and the willingness to adjust and change your actions to dynamic conditions and unexpected events.
Can I put it?
Sure.
Mike Tyson.
Oh, yeah, the great philosopher
The
Mike
great
Tyson
philosopher,
said,
the fighter. What did he
everyone
say?
makes a plan until they get punched in the mouth.
That's it.
Yeah.
It always, everybody got this plan.
And you are going to get punched in the mouth in life. And to put it back in a corporate context, especially in safety departments, we see a lot of folks in corporations, and safety spends all its time reactively trying to prevent things that happened in the past. And they focus on no bad things happening. No slips, no trips, no falls. Don't pinch yourself. Don't do this. Don't do that. Don't have a fire. They prevent things from happening. And the way we looked at it was, you're not going to stop bad things from happening because it's just the nature of the human condition, right? We're all fallible. So spend your time, effort, and resources and planning to focus on what you want to happen and how you want it to happen. And if you set a very precise goal for how you want things to happen, safety will be baked in. Of course, you'll be safe. We never sat in our brief and said, don't crash on launch, don't hit each other on join up, don't run out of gas, don't bomb the wrong target. We
Which
didn't
is
focus.
all negative.
Yeah, we didn't focus on what we weren't going to do. We always focused on how we were going to do it, what we wanted to happen, and how it was most likely to happen. And did it ever go that way? No, Mike Tyson, we get punched in the face. But we had the means and the will to adjust and still succeed in our mission. So if you translate that into a Christian life, so many of us are obsessed with don't sin, don't do bad things, right? Don't have negative things in our life. Where if you turn it on its head, if we're to build adaptive Christian capacity, we're seeking a closer relationship with God. We're seeking to listen and know his will and try to do what he has prepared for us. We're trying to lead others into the rest and grace, which is that personal relationship, because unpredictable things and unexpected things are going to happen in our life. And if we spent that time to build ourselves up as Christians and build up our Christian communities, we'll be able to weather whatever storm comes through with the grace of God.
And it takes a team.
Yeah. And so all of those things, just it's a team sport, it takes a team. If you want to maximize that team's performance, start with relationships and build trust, hold each other mutually accountable. That learning, boy, that learning, we used to be really rough in our debriefs. We would just tear ourselves up, every little thing we did wrong. But it came out of a kindness and a true deep caring about somebody to really critique them at that level. So go from learning to implementation and don't seek to be. I heard this in church the other week. Don't seek to be nice. Don't seek to be pleasant. Seek to be truly kind, to truly be invested in care for that other person and try to make them better and make yourself better. And that last one is build positive capacity. Don't just, what was the old Google slogan years ago? Don't be evil, right? That's not enough. You have to be good.
And you just got it and just do it.
Yeah, just do it, right?
Just do
Nike.
it.
Yeah,
Yeah,
just
that's
do it.
it. I still kind of want to go back though. And okay, you kind of had a progressive, I don't mean that in a political sense. I mean you it sounds like your trip into Christianity was a process. It wasn't like you went to a camp and within 3 hours kumbaya, that was it.
Oh, that makes sense to me. Okay. Yeah,
No.
it wasn't that.
Some people have that, and that's
Sure.
great, but a lot of people don't, and they're kind of struggling, like, well, I haven't had really had a big flash in the sky, or I haven't heard a voice. So am I saved yet? Am I saved yet? You know, and that's a tough one. You know, different people come to Jesus in different ways. I mean, I was a very gradual process. I tended to intellectualize it all through college, all through my early, you know, my 20s and my 30s, and I knew Jesus. I believed Jesus existed, but I wasn't ready to follow Jesus. It was like, oh yeah, you know, it that's I get it. Yeah, there's no doubt. Yeah, you know, but you know what? Who knows Jesus better than anybody? The devil. You know, he knows Jesus. He knows the Bible. He knows God. He's got it backwards, forwards. He knows all of the verses by heart. There's no doubt about it. He knows it. And I'm not saying I was the devil, but obviously the devil doesn't follow Jesus. He's out to destroy, to get to know, as he perceives it, his enemy, and destroy him through us in many, many ways, which he's never going to be successful, but that's his goal. That's what he wants to do. And if he can't destroy God, then he can at least, in his own way, through us, hurt God. Because every time he takes a soul away and gets it for himself, that hurts God because he loves us so much. That's how I perceive it. So there is an intellectual level, but at some point you finally just have to let go.
I
Let
would
go and let God.
let go. There's a degree of obedience or capitulation there where
Yes, surrender.
you've got to stop trying to do it yourself and realize your dependency. And really, surrender, capitulate, and just give yourself over.
And you're never going to have all the answers.
No,
You're not.
you're not.
You've got to accept that, and that's where the trust comes in. I don't understand why I have a child with special needs. I don't understand why my wife got sick and has to go in and have an operation where she may die. I don't understand why I suddenly have cancer. I don't understand. There's just so many things, you know. So it's very difficult to surrender and say, okay, you got a bigger plan than mine. I thought my plan was pretty good, but I got a feeling your plan is better. So I got to surrender my plan over to your plan.
And sometimes we can see it in retrospect. We sure don't see it at the time,
No.
but looking back, it certainly isn't on the list of what I wanted, but boy, was it on the list of what I needed, and I didn't know it at the time.
Right, right. So and we all have battles. Every day we have battles. You know, and it can be inconsequential. Like I've been battling weeds in my front pasture. So finally I went down there and just obliterated them. I mowed them down. They're going to come back. You know, but at least it looks better now. You know, we all have battles. Maybe it's I gave you my example of a battle. You know, we just all have battles every day, you know, trying to stay positive, trying to be helpful to other people, trying to not get depressed or worried too much. Worry, worry. You know, we all have those individual battles. And that's why it's so important, a community of people there to lean on and lean into. And I guess I'm talking about church, you know, just going to church, getting to know people there. I got friends I can call up. I'm sure you're the same way. You got friends you can call up.
Yeah, 3 o'clock in the morning, friends, we call them.
Oh my.
You call them anytime. You can call them anytime, day or night, and they'll pick up the phone, no questions
Maybe I
asked.
should try that. See if they'll answer the phone. Oh. So what's your focus now?
Professionally, spiritually.
Whatever your move to say, what's your focus now?
Yeah, I would say
I think
there's
you're very goal oriented.
Yeah,
As
there's.
a person, you know, your military background, you were successful in water polo, you got a scholarship, you went, you know, on and on and on and on. You're very goal oriented. And so, you know, what's your focus today?
Yeah, it's spiritually is to constantly grow and take my own advice, right? Be more proactive, do more of the do, build a greater community. Don't think that you need every tool and every understanding to be able to reach out. Another great philosopher, Patton, and I'm paraphrasing, said something to the effect of an 80% plan executed violently today is better than the perfect plan 2 weeks too late. You're never going to be fully equipped to engage. So just go out there and do your best, right? And then learn and recover. From a family-oriented aspect, every parent of a child with special needs will have a thought. And once they have this thought, they can't unthink it, which is, I am the support system for my son or daughter. What will happen when I'm not here in this world? And once you have that thought, you become very keenly focused in a very loving way to build independence in that child. So that is an ongoing, daily, weekly, monthly, constant battle for us, is how do we build our daughter up? How do we equip her? How do we make sure that she can continue to thrive when we're no longer on this earth? And I'll tell you, back to the point of this podcast, Almost Paradise, that definitely goes in the book. We could not think of a better community. Back to why is it Almost Paradise? Because the people, she's over here in Bonner's Ferry and she has an awesome support system, whether it's at the church where she goes with you and your lovely wife, and what do you call your little group there? The Silver Aces?
The Silver Saints.
Silver Saints, that's right. The Silver Saints are literally watching over my daughter in the church to help her regulate and understand. She took it upon herself. She was baptized as a little baby, but she called me up one day and said, "Dad, I want to be baptized again." And there I was down at Lake Pend'Oreille, just south of us, with her. Great, great honor to participate in that affirmation of her faith. And having a hand, having a great community in that pursuit of independence for my daughter, knowing that it's a trusting, caring, we've got a lot of eyes on here in small town Bonner's Ferry. And again,
Special Olympics.
Special Olympics is another one. Just the activities. She was just in a play, the lovely old Rex Theater here, did
Yes.
its first live play in 90 years. It had a great flood. There are watermarks on the wall where that old building had flooded out. And they just were able to carry on their first live play in over 90 years. And she was able to participate and have a great supporting role in that. So what a wonderful community of support helping me and my wife navigate that giant life challenge. So that's a lot of our focus.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. So it's almost paradise in a lot of ways. It can be better. We can work on making it better and be aware of its positives and be aware of its weaknesses and work on it accordingly. So anything else, Mike, that you want to touch on before we close this down or move to another topic or whatever?
No, I appreciate you, and I appreciate you using the wonderful medium of a podcast to spread the word about Northern Idaho, but don't spread it too far and too wide. We kind of
No,
like our space up here.
my
And
signal doesn't go beyond like
yeah.
30 miles. That's it.
And
Yeah.
I believe your listeners can find the application to move here somewhere online, hidden in bureaucracy. But like I said, people are both a blessing and a challenge. But I do appreciate you, do appreciate your platform, and I do appreciate your focus of just literally getting the word capital W out there to all your listeners.
I want to encourage people, if you have any questions for Mike or me, you can Google me. Send me an email at almost, no, what is my email? NorthIdahoPodcast@gmail.com. I got too many emails. And send that to me and I can get it to Mike. And Mike, you do seminars, you do stuff for your business, right?
Yeah, we do a lot of keynotes, speeches, things like that.
Right. So you might want to get in touch with him and find out, what's he had to offer that might be beneficial for you. Maybe you're a veteran and you're struggling,
Yeah.
and I'm sure Mike would be happy to visit with you and have coffee.
Certainly, and if you go back in the podcast library, you'll find about wonderful veterans outreach going on here
Yes.
just in northern Idaho area itself and
Yeah.
veterans
You're
advocacy.
never alone, guys. All you got to do is reach out. Just contact, phone call, or whatever. And do you have a email address or something that you'd like to share?
Sure, if you're interested in learning about what some other veterans are doing in the consulting space to improve organizations, leaders, and promote operational learning, Our company is called Spartan Training and Performance, and our website is spartantp.com.
Okay, and that'll get things going, to get things going. Okay, well, thanks everybody for listening, and I have a another I have a missionary who has gone to Guatemala to help them find water coming in on Monday. And I'm going to be learning more about what's going on in Guatemala with water, because the things we take so for granted here. I mean, this is in so many ways almost paradise here in North America in general. There's a lot of places in the world that water is a daily struggle.
Right.
Just water, good water that doesn't make you sick. And so he's involved in that, and we're going to talk about that and opportunities where if you want to become a missionary and go and help out with that. He's putting together a group to do that later, I think after the first of the year. He's been down there once or twice, and so he kind of knows the ropes. So if you want to have some interesting changes in your life and make a difference, you might want to tune in and listen to that. So we'll see what happens. Okay? Thanks, Mike.
It's been a
And
pleasure.
all right.
High Flight by John Gillespie McGee Jr. Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter-silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed and joined the tumbling mirth of sun-split clouds and done 100 things you have not dreamed of, wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence, hovering there. I've chased the shouting wind along and flung my eager craft through footless halls of air. Up, up the long, delirious, burning blue, I've topped the windswept heights with easy grace, where never lark or even eagle flew. And while, with silent, lifting mind, I've trod the high, untrespassed sanctity of space, put out my hand and touched the face of God.